So I guess yesterday, Frank Wilczek have a quite a list of theoretic challenges for this field, in particular strong interaction and QCD. I think still experimentally there are also quite a lot of challenges. The main problem is really the lack of tools that Tom Hammock would like to put in his garage, and also it has to come with a manual, right? So the real problem is really the heavy-eye interaction that the lifetime is extremely short, maybe on the order of few fermi, maybe 10 fermi, and the small size, the size in the space in spatial dimension is also quite small, and on top of this, you have really rapid expansion. So the problem that we are addressing is that how, in this kind of realistic interaction collision case, you can ask yourself that whether there is strong interaction in the initial case, whether you have thermalization, even though we have been using thermal model all the time, and then whether what is, if we can address this question, and then what is the initial density that we are creating in the initial stage of interaction, and most importantly, whether you have seen deconfinement. So this will be the only distraction of this talk. Ordinarily, we have many tools like computed tomography. And at the center of this experiment or probe is that you really have to have a very well calibrated source. For example, in this case, X-ray. You have to know its luminosity and its spectrum. And then you have to understand what is the absorption property of the material that you're studying. And then afterwards, by detecting the final X-ray coming through this material and through absorption, and you detect the final deflected or absorbed X-ray spectrum, and then you have to go through computer-assisted correction. You have to take into account what kind of material that accounts for different absorption. And finally, going through all this case, and then hopefully you can get an image out of this. That's really a difficult task for heavy ion physics, as you know, you don't actually have a static system there waiting for you to shoot a laser on it. But fortunately, nature is also kind that we do have some kind of jet production in heavy ion interaction, especially at collider energies, even though those events only happen very rarely. But when you go to high PT momentum, and they are dominant mechanism of particle production, so you know they are produced by jet production, and that can be used as a probe in this case. So the problem is that how do you calibrate this beam of jet that is produced amongst the heavy-ion interaction? There's two ways. One is that you can do experiments like in PP interaction, where the jet is simply produced in a vacuum and hydrolyzed in a vacuum. So there is no additional medium effect. And or you can use theoretical calculation, that is, if you can trust the theorist calculation. But in this case, that we do see that the at least the lowest or the, at least the perturbative QCD calculation of high PT spectrum do agree quite well with experimental measurement in PP or PP bar case. So the next question is that you have to ask what is the jet absorption or part absorption property going through this medium that you produce, and then whether you have to take into account the distortion due to the fact that the system is not static, it is an expanding system. So hopefully after you address all these questions, then you can put all this theoretical understanding into your computer and make the correction, and hopefully you can get some imaging of the dense matter you created in heavy ion interaction. So this is the outline of my talk, and thanks to Ralph that I don't have to go through the introduction of long history of induced radiation inside the medium and LPM effect. So I will go straight through to what I want to concentrate in my talk, that is the modified proton from hedging function in QCD. And then I will compare two different cases after using this theoretic framework, that I will compare to the cold nuclear matter, which has been studied in deep inelastic scattering of a nuclear matter, and that is Hermes experiments, and heavy ion interaction at weak. And then finally, I will make a conclusion and remarks. I should emphasize that this approach we have is really based on a field theory approach, which is a little bit different than the conventional method that you have to rely on the assumption of static model, static potential model assumption of well-separated scatter centers. So the question in this problem is that unlike in QED case, where you can actually directly measure the induced Bremsstrom, the photon coming out, or you can measure the electron directly and measure its energy compared to its initial energy. In QCD case, you cannot really do that because you can all you see at the final state is hadrons, and you don't know whether this hadron is coming from the leading quark or it's coming from the induced radiation. All you see is just hadrons coming from the jet. So if you measure the total energy loss, the total energy of the jet, you know, using calorimetry in your detector, you don't see much change in total energy, given the case that the jet energy profile does not really change dramatically. And what you do see will be the particle distribution inside this jet, and that is what normally people call the from hedging function of the jet. And what it does, that we proposed this some time ago, that essentially the energy loss will just lead to the modification of the from hedging function, and that is the softening of the from hedging function at a very large z here. And then the problem is that how can we calculate this? So I'm going to set up this problem in the simplest case that ever you can imagine, is that you look at this deep inelastic scattering of a nuclear matter, so where the photon, the virtual photon, simply knocked out a quark, and from the measurement of the electron energy, you know exactly what is the initial energy of this quark, and that is transferred from the electron, and then in the nuclear matter, of course, this quark will suffer multiple scattering when it traverse this nuclear matter. That's nucleus. Yeah, nucleons, yes. I don't want to waste my time explaining the cartoon on my in this problem, if you the leading contribution is that jet will not interact at all with any nuclear medium, just produced and travel outside. So in the leading order and leading twist, you can actually calculate the inclusive spectrum of hadron production from this jet fragmentation, and you find out that the cross section, the inclusive cross section, factorized into this proton the quark, in this case the quark distribution function inside your nucleus, and then the hard process of quark and photon scattering, and finally the fragmentation function of this jet into a hadron, which carries fraction of ZH of the initial quark energy. And you can see that in this is just a very simplified factorization problem in QCD. And all those elements here, the proton dispersion function and the fermentation function, can be defined very well in field theory, even though they cannot be calculated. But you can use other experiments like deep inelastic scattering, a total cross section, where you can measure the quark distribution function. You can use E plus and minus experiments to measure the fermentation function of this quark, which should be universal and should not depend on which process you are looking at. And the only thing you can calculate, of course, is this hard process. Going to the next order, that you know immediately that this this quark can be produced virtual, highly offshore, and then they can have radiation. So this is what I call radiation induced by the quark photon scattering. And this is just a normal QCD cascade in the vacuum. And you can calculate that modification, this because of this radiation, and that you can that will change your fermentation function, and you can calculate the splitting function, which is the essentially quark radiated gluon, and this will lead to simply the global evolution equation of your fermentation function. So as you increase the Q square of this photon, and then it will be the probability of for the quark to radiate a gluon will increase, and that naturally will soften your quark fermentation function as you increase your Q square. When you have to introduce multiple scattering as in my next transparency, and naturally the gluon radiation should be similar. Except that the only difference is that that gluon radiation is induced by the medium rather than induced by this hot scattering. And that should have similar effect, that is that will lead to the softening of the fermentation function. And you can see that from here the form, the problem is very similar, and the final result should resemble this result in a vacuum. And to do that, actually, we used the generalized factorization involving multiple scattering in QCD. And for this case, we consider, for example, after they produced a quark when it's kicked out of the nucleus, and it will scatter again with another gluon from the nucleus. And then you can simply count the field. In this case, I'm now using the covariant gauge, and then there's this quark field here, and then you this mesh elements of cross section should depend on the gluon field of this. And then to proceed, we do so-called collinear expansion. You simply calculate the hard process here, and assuming there is initial transversal momentum carried by the initial gluon, and you do expansion according around k square equals zero. So there is a first term, and there is a linear term, and there is a quadratic term. And when you do that, and you find out that the leading term here, the first term, when k power equals zero, essentially it will leads to a so-called iconic correction of the leading twist contribution. And it's not really a physical process. All you have to do, all it does is combine the one gluon correction, and then gives you this the iconic correction of the fermentation the proton dispersion function inside your nucleus, and it only makes your proton dispersion function getting invariant. And then if you consider unpolarized process, of course you find out that this linear term also will not contribute because it's only linear in k probe, and after integration over k probe it should be zero. So the leading contribution, the true to physical process, comes from the quadratic expansion here, where you have k power square. And I put this k power square into this and do a partial integration so that this A field becomes the field strength here. So the final result, the true contribution, the only contribution coming from this is the quadratic contribution here, that is proportional to these metric elements, which depend on not only quark, but also the gluon fields inside the nucleus. And then I can also calculate this too. So in this, so if you do that, and this is the idea behind this so-called twist expansion, and if you calculate the leading twist, which is not without double scattering, and you find out that the differential cross section for radiant gluon is simply proportional to the probability, of course, finding a quark in your nucleus, and then this is proportional to of S, and there is this collinear divergence, which is L pop square. And I assume that I neglect so far now the nuclear effect on the pattern diffusion function. So I assume that this is a quark distribution function in the nucleus. In the nucleus is proportional to A times of that in the nucleon. And then in this double scattering case, as I demonstrate that, the final result is proportional to this two pattern correlation function inside a nucleus. And if I neglect long-range color correlation inside nucleus, which means that these two gluons can only come from a single nucleon, and then you find out that the integration over the phase space here, of the spatial distance here, one of them essentially gives you the distance of the nucleon here, the dimension of the nucleon, and the other integration, of course, can move across the nucleus, and then it will give you another dimension of a to the 1/3. So in on top of this linear A dependence, that's why this A 1/3 will give you this A to the 4th dependence here. And then in addition, you have this double scattering will be proportional to the gluon distribution function of a nucleon. And then because this is high twist, naturally it will be suppressed by order of one L pop square. So this will be the L pop to the 4th, and then there's additional Fs coming from the gluon scattering. So if you combine this all together, you find out that relative to the leading contribution, the double scattering have this correction of this form, which is proportional to Fs and h to the 1/3, and then divided by L pop square and proportional to the gluon distribution function. And then there is this coefficient here, which I will come back to later to discuss what is coefficient about. So this is my expansion parameter. I'm only looking at process, of course, with small Fs. But I have to make sure my A is large, significantly large, so that the other terms, which is have the similar order here of S and L pop, but is not proportional to A. For example, if those gluons can come from the same nucleon as the quark, and that is what I call the two leading, the two high twist effect, but it's not proportional to the A to the 1/3. It's simply suppressed when you have, it's not a leading when you have very large A. And as I will explain to you later, that because of this interference effect, this LPM effect, you find out that the effective contribution of the gluon radiation comes from the phase space that requires that the transversal momentum of the gluon has to be large to a certain value. And that value happens to be, in this case, it's Q squared divided by the H to the 1/3. So if you put this into this, you find out that the double scattering now is proportional to the quadratically on the size of the nuclear, is A to the 2/3 instead of A to the 1/3. And then, of course, it's a high twist, it should be suppressed by Q squared. And if you look at this double scattering process in detail, you find out there is two distinct contributions. One is that the gluon radiation is essentially induced by the quark and photon scattering. This is very similar like in a vacuum. And then after this radiation, this quark becomes unsure. And this unsure quark can scatter with another gluon from the nucleus. But since this gluon is induced by this, and this by the first quark hard scattering here, and then the energy you find out, the energy carried by this second gluon can be very soft. In fact, it can be actually zero. So this is what we call a soft rescattering. So you have first half scattering with the photon and with gluon radiation, and then after that the quark will have just a soft scattering with another gluon from the nucleus. And now of course another process you can think about in the same process, in the same diagram, is that immediately after the quark photon scattering, the quark can become unsure. And then instead, this gluon radiation essentially is induced by this this secondary rescattering, and because this photon is induced by this rescattering, and that you can kinematically that requires you that this gluon from the nuclear has to carry finite momentum fraction, and that finite momentum fraction is determined by the transverse momentum of the radiated gluon, and also the fractional longitudinal momentum carried by this gluon. And then in this particular process, you can find out that in this particular diagram, both of this contribute, and also the interference between these two process. And since this gluon is induced by this secondary gluon, you find out that relative to this process, and the amplitude of these metric elements of this radiation has a relative phase difference from this. So if you combine this, you square this and this, and including the interference term, and finally find out that this cutting diagram, for example, is proportional to this some kind of a dipole form interaction. And you immediately realize this is really the manifest of the LPM effect. Because you can look at this the fraction momentum carried by gluon and invert that, and that you can define that as the formation time of the gluon radiation, and as soon as formation time is much smaller than much larger than the nuclear size, which is given by the spatial coordinate, you find that this is complete cancel. You don't have any induced radiation anymore. And the only contribution you have is coming from the hot scattering. And then you do calculation, there's many diagrams you have to calculate. In addition, you have to consider interference of double scattering or triple scattering with no rescattering. And after all that, you find out that very similar in the vacuum case, all this induced radiation do is to create extra term of the effective fermentation function. And then the effective fermentation function can, similarly like in a vacuum case, can be expressed like this similar the Glapp type of equation here, except that the splitting function is now become this what I call effective modified splitting function, which depends on the two-particle coalescing function, the two-particle coalescing function of the nucleus. And now I put this LPM effect in interference into this definition of the two-particle coalescing function. So the LPM effect is now embedded into my two-particle coalescing function here. And in fact, you can find out that if you decompose this, there's four terms, and so this two-particle coalescing function has essentially have four independent particle metric elements of nucleus. And one of them, this is typical of the mesh elements, is that you because of the interference effect, so you take out one quark, another gluon from the nucleus, which with momentum x1 and is x2 plus xl, and then you put back a gluon into the nucleus, but with different momentum, and then the momentum is transferred to a quark. So in this case, there is a momentum transfer from gluon to this quark, and this is what we call momentum crossed metric elements of the nucleus. And you can study these metric elements by assuming some kind of fork expansion of a single nucleon state like this. And in this particular assumption, you can actually calculate this two-particle coalescing function or twist four mesh elements in terms of two nucleon distribution function. And because of this momentum crossing, you find out that what enters here is not actually the simple proton distribution function of a nucleon. In fact, it's what enters here is what people call a generalized proton distribution function, or some people call it a screwed proton distribution function. Skewed, yeah, not screwed. And you can also call it off forward proton distribution function. And this actually is a quite general subject people have discussed extensively in deep inelastic scattering, and people by looking at virtual deeply competent scattering, you can measure actually this generalized proton distribution function, and that in principle can tell you the spin content and the angular momentum and spin content of the our nucleon. But it's very nice to see that actually this same proton distribution function actually enters here in multiple scattering in a nucleon. But in the past, people simply have used this factorized form. They simply assume that this twist form proton mesh elements can be factorized into a quark distribution plus a gluon distribution. And this is just assumption without much justification. So we actually verify that by doing numerical calculation in our case, and we find out that this kind of factorization actually is pretty good approximation in a limited range of kinematic region, in particular when the initial fraction momentum of the quark is larger than the momentum fraction carried by the gluon. And you find out that in this region is pretty constant. And then you have some correction on order of 20% that you have to do. But in this one, when x is much smaller than xL, you find out this factorization completely fails. But you can use that actually to argue that if I look at my experiments in this particular region, so I can actually measure or probe the generalized proton distribution function of nucleon using nucleus target. And in fact, so use this, if I do this factorization, which I will use in my calculation, and then you find that you can predict what is the constant here. And this is this constant is essentially you find is related to the Fermi momentum of the nucleon inside the nucleus. And which we consider is is of course it depends on size of the nucleus, and we assume this constant is about 1, and the gluon distribution function at very small x is about 3, and using this and we get this constant here. So this is what we predict of the modification of proton distribution, the Fermi-Pechin function, in the deep inelastic scattering, and naturally you will see that the suppression is the largest for large z, and then as you decrease z, the suppression becomes smaller, and eventually if you go to extremely smaller z, and then the induced radiation will also contribute to the proton distribution function. So this ratio here will be above 1. And the point here is what Hermes measurement. And so in order to fit this experiments, what we did is that we simply look at our calculation, and this is one single parameter we have to fix. And we used, so by fitting one of the point here, or the general suppression factor here, and we find that this is 0.0065. The shape is completely a prediction. And most importantly, the nuclear size dependence. And this is for nitrogen target, and this is on krypton target. So this is actually the first time you see the quadratic nuclear size dependence of the modification. And I think this is really gratifying to see that. And the same kind of mesh elements actually also enters into the calculation of Dirac-Yen PD broadening. And using this paper, you can extract the same kind of constant which they have in this particular paper is by 0.008. And then this is comparing to our prediction using this convolution model, we have like 0.004. So roughly, this actually agree in the ballpark. And then if we insist that this is the actual constant, and from there you can actually fix the Fermi motion momentum in the nucleus.
This C is some density. Why is it so small? It's so small.
The size of the nucleus.
What?
The size of the nucleus does not determine Fermi motion. Even very large nuclei have the same Fermi motion.
Well, what I assume that is that this is the transverse momentum sharing in this case. Maybe it's a mistake for me to call it Fermi motion, but this is essentially the transverse momentum sharing between two nuclei, and of course that should be restricted by the nuclear size in this case. Maybe it's a mistake for me to call them Fermi motion here, but this is simply the parameter that enters in my model here. Yeah, let me finish this. I have to get to my punchline here. And then this is the energy dependence here. And as you increase the initial part of energy, and this the suppression actually goes away. So as the theoretical exercise, you can actually calculate what is the energy loss of the proton. You simply assume that the proton energy loss is simply equivalent to the energy carried by the gluon. And so you can calculate that in this case, and using this. Using this factor fixed by the experiments, you find out the energy loss is about, in the Fermi experiments, implies that energy loss is about 0.5 GeV per Fermi in a god nuclear. Yes. And now comes into the expanding medium. Expanding medium now, you really have to, this is now a leap of faith. I have not really done this. In principle, you should calculate this measure elements in a medium. I believe that you cannot really calculate that perturbatively, especially when the temperature is around phase transition. But if I use my naive model of protons, assume there's a weakly or non-interaction, then I can identify this as the gluon density profile. And then this gluon density, gluon distribution function essentially is related to gluon scattering cross-section in the medium. And finally, I can calculate energy loss, which is a line integral of the gluon density in this medium as the as quark travels across. And in this case, you notice that if I calculate this, and for static medium, so this is the gluon density is remain constant over time, so the line integral essentially is give you this. But if my proton density decreases with time, and so the total effective energy loss essentially is this area here. And even if my initial density is as high as the steady case, my total energy loss is completely different. So the expansion completely distorts your radiation spectrum. And in fact, you can relate the total energy loss in one-dimensional expanding case to the steady case, and it should be multiplied by this factor. Which is the size of nuclei and multiply the initial time. This time is not the normalization time, is what I consider the time of the materialization of the medium and that you are probing.
What scale of down?
Excuse me?
What scale
of S? I didn't hear you.
On which scale it is defined?
Fs, oh. Fs, okay. I mean, depends on which problem. If you're in Hermes experiments, there's a Q square. You see, I use the Q square there to define my Fs. In that particular case, the Q square is about 2 GeV square, and Fs is by 0.3. What?
Doesn't depend on rho.
That's not depend on rho?
Not on rho.
No, not in this case. There could be high order correction. Yeah, sure. Not in my case. So if I do that, and then I compare, I assume that this hadron suppression is caused by this energy loss, and then you can extract the effective energy loss extracted from the spectrum, which is again is by 0.5 GeV per Fermi. So if you take into account this distortion effect due to the expansion, You conclude that if I assume this materialization time is 0.2 for me, and you find out the initial energy loss at the corresponding static limit is about 70 eV for Fermi, which is about 15 times higher than that number you get it from the cool nuclear matter. And this number actually is not really outrageous, because if you compare the initial particle density in your system and compare that to the ordinary nuclear matter, you find that this is a factor of 15 is quite reasonable. And then this comes back to the energy dependence here, as we have seen in deep inelastic scattering here. So it will disappear as you increase energy of the initial quark, and that's really because the energy dependence of the.
It's a really big question.
Sure. And then this essentially is the prediction here, which you compare to this. So as you increase your PT, in this case, in heavy ion interaction case, so this ratio essentially will rise. And approaching one, and which of course is still very different from the PA case where there is no energy loss. So let me come to my conclusion here. I will skip the anisotropy. I will skip the what I call the ultimate experiments where you actually can use a photon to tag the jet, so you know the initial energy of the jet. So this will give you a very clean measurement. By that time, there were no question about what is initial rate of the jet production, what about shattering and stuff like that. So this is my conclusion here. I think you can read it yourself. I'll stop here.
Are there a lot of questions?
I have a simple question. I mean, if you used your modified fragmentation function that you did in cold matter and just applied that to RIC, how does that change things?
That's what I did.
And you didn't get enough.
That's what I did. So I used the modified fragmentation function and calculate the inclusive Hadron spectrum.
Right.
And then of course there is the ground density that enters.
Right.
So I have to adjust this ground density. Ground density.
I see.
And to feed the data, and then that the total energy loss, that's what I get.
Right, because you're doing two separate calculations. One is calculating the modified fragmentation functions from cold nuclear matter.
Yes.
And that's
no,
that's
pres- no, 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 no. The fragmentation function, I assume that the fragmentation function, the modification, the medium modification of fragmentation function,
right.
In this case should be independent of what is the density of your nuclear of your matter.
Right.
Yeah.
You're assuming it's universal.
It should be independent. Because I demonstrate what enters into the calculation essentially is the matter elements of the ground correlation function on your medium.
Right.
Yeah. And this is one remark of this I want to emphasize here that. That we assume some kind of simple idea of proton gas, but if you calculate this, ground correlation function in a medium, it's not all clear that it will linearly depend on the ground density. During the TC, the phase transition, there could be some kind of structure, which, is not for me. It's out of question. I cannot calculate that.
Both structure function and fragmentation functions are involves non-perturbative physics, which eventually they have to be determined at some scale from the experimental data. Okay, both structure function and fragmentation function. And the structure function of the gluon inside nucleus is not measured. So how do you know what much of the modification gone to the gluon structure function inside nucleus, and how much of modification into the fragmentation function has gone?
Yeah. First of all, I think the fragmentation function of gluon is measured in the plus minus.
In nucleus, inside nucleus.
Oh, no.
That's what I'm saying. So there is.
I simply rely on the proton fragmentation function that is measured in the vacuum, in E plus minus case, and use that to calculate the medium modification in this case. I use that as input in my case. So I assume the only medium modification is due to gluon, induced gluon radiation. So I can calculate that.
Your effect is a higher twist effect. Do you have any
experimental evidence for the 1 over Q squared behavior, which you say is important?
Unfortunately, the Hermes experiments is in a very limited kinematic region. So the Q square is very small. And so far they have not seen the Q square. I mean, it does not very much. So what can I say? But they do see this energy dependence there. AMC? Yeah, okay. NMC measurement is a very different story, because the kinematic is in such a region, the initial energy of the quark is extremely high. It's about between 50 and 100 GeV, and you are really measuring very small effect. I mean, if you see my plot here, I go back to the energy dependence here. You can see the if you go to 50 GeV, 100 GeV, you are really measuring very small effect. So that's why that's so unique about Hermes experiments. They are just sitting in the right kinematic region. You can really see the effect of this multiple scattering effect.
I have two questions. I guess the first one has to do with this infrared cutoff. All these calculations are sensitive to infrared cutoffs. If I'm not misquoting him, the previous speaker said he thought because of that, these calculations are only good for PT above 10 GeV. You're showing calculations that are, at least at RIC, that are much lower. What are your thoughts about the validity at moderate PT?
Yeah. From my calculation, I don't see any limitation of the energy of the initial quark. And you can see here the energy, that's true. This here, I studied only about 8 GeV here. But in principle, I don't see any imitation of that in my case.
So you think they're infrared stable?
Yeah.
Okay. The other question was, you show this very large energy loss at RIC, but you've also done this analysis at the SPS where you find a very small energy loss and presumably not that much lower initial energy density.
I always say, if you've done something, you always come back to haunt you. I think to answer that question is I don't have a very sort of like very rigid argument on any exact calculation to answer your question. But from what I have argued at the very end, that you really have to correct the distortion due to the expansion case. And the expansion actually really is suppress your total energy by significant factor, by factor of 10. So if there is some small amount of energy loss at SPS, and because of the expansion, it's not necessarily you will be able to see that at SPS. And secondly, it's not all clear the lifetime of the dense matter at SPS is the same as at RIC. And if you take this both this into account, and those two results are not necessarily contradicting with each other.
Taking account this plot, could you now put up the where you compare to the Phoenix pi zeros, just the standard suppression plot? Next one. I want the ratio.
Yes.
Yeah. So your calculation immediately heads back up towards one. My question is that a firm prediction?
Which one is a PA?
Talking about 0.6. PA? Okay. In any case, if we would show that the suppression continues to grow at larger PT, what would this say about your mechanism and your predictions? I mean, you seem to indicate that the Phoenix pi zeros are in the range where the suppression is largest. Is that a firm prediction, or do you have some wiggle room there?
I think that this is. This prediction, of course, is based on the assumption that what you see here is indeed caused by a part of energy loss. And if that parameter I get from there is robust, and then this prediction should be.
My question about the general contour.
The general contour is a fact you cannot escape. And eventually, this is a very acute, this is a high toxicity effect. If you go to very large PT, eventually the factorization should work.
Yeah,
and
but
then
is this the right momentum scale?
Yeah.
Maybe I just misunderstood a technical point, but it seems to me that you get a scale introduced to the problem that comes from the fact that you require sort of local color neutralization on a nucleon, right? You require that a gluon...
That's for nucleon case, yes.
Well, but
that's
that,
for the nuclear case, yes.
For the nuclear case,
yes.
Right. Okay, but now that condition should be completely different when I have, you know, let's say... Mm-hmm. Unconfined gluons.
That's exactly my point of my comment to Raju's question. That it's because what enters here essentially is the gluon correlation function here, and in the nucleus, I know there's color confinement, so I can calculate this, and then this gives me the right A dependence. But in a quark-gluon plasma, if you assume that this non-interacting, or weakly interacting, you can also calculate and find out that lens actually is not controlled by the bias screening lens there. But that's again is assumption of perturbation expansion. But I think what you should do is essentially to calculate the symmetric elements especially during the phase transition region here.
But can you, I mean, so maybe this comes back to the other question, but if somehow that scale gets significantly smaller, right, then you may all of a sudden start getting sensitive to infrared problems, right? Because it's really the presence of that scale in your cold nuclear matter case that means you're not sensitive to...
It could be right. Yeah, it could be right, because that scale is now hidden in my measure elements, which I cannot calculate. And I only can only assume something, like in ideal gas, I can do that. But if it's strong interacting plasma, I really cannot really answer your question. And that's that probably you have to rely on some other calculation.
Can you give us a general feeling for the differences between what you did and what the previous speaker did and whether they get the same answers, and it's fairly important for us to understand how robust these calculations are. Can you give us a feeling for that? And first of all, you might start with just explaining the differences between the two calculations.
Yeah, you really put me on the spot. Okay, deep inside, I'm a nice guy. I think the difference. This is, of course, this is biased because I'm talking about my calculation. The difference is that that we actually really look at this case more realistically. We used the measured permission function, and we calculate the modification of the permission function due to induced radiation. We are not using, we are not simply shifting the energy of the quark by a certain amount, right? And on top of that, of course, we assume that the initial production rate should not be modified, right? So the rate of the jet production should not be modified by the quark-gluon plasma, which is formed later on. And this is essentially the ingredient in our calculation. And to Rolf, you probably can rebut me on this. I think in their calculation, they simply used very simplified Cartan spectrum of power law, which is, I would call it, some kind of toy model.
Okay. You mentioned yesterday how to play with toys. I'm not so familiar with playing with toys. But the point is that I guess we will not disagree on your discussion of fragmentation function in deep inelastic. But I think there is a significant...
I'm sorry, what do you say?
We probably will not disagree on your analysis of the fragmentation function in deep inelastic and the A effects, but
I really don't think you can do that.
No, okay. But I agree on...
Which I don't see. I don't see that.
But there is not the case. Point for us
because
to...
you have not calculated the modified fragmentation function.
Conceptually.
Oh.
Conceptually.
No. No. What I'm saying that I don't agree that he agrees with me.
Conceptually, there is not a point to discuss it. The point is that in this large PT phenomena, I think where we do not agree is that these jets which are produced by hard scatterings, and there you have really to take into account already its deepness, which I mentioned before. And this is, this triggers or gives a bias to the probability of emitting gluons. It's just cheaper not to emit too many gluons, and actually less than the average. And it's much more cheaper in the steep spectrum to emit even virtual gluons. And this is what we take into account. And this is not, to my opinion, enough to incorporate into the fragmentation function, because the fragmentation function is not steep enough. I mean, you may take part of this effect into account the way Xinyan does it. So, but we just did it in a more phenomenological way, that's clear. But we tried to include the full steepness of the PT spectrum, and only the part which comes due to the medium effect. So in this, we do not agree.
So so this is at least what we did, that you calculate the hadron spectrum by convoluting the rate of this jet production here, and then convolute with the fragmentation function here, and this Z is simply is PT of hadron versus ET of the jet. So this is what you do in just not ordinary, and then what you did is that then you have to integrate over all PT, of course, and then in a medium case we simply replace this by what we call that modified. And then of course you can see that we didn't do what you said, we didn't do this shifting, we just induced, we just used this modified.
Sorry, I didn't say that you do shifting.
Excuse me.
I didn't say that you did shifting.
Yeah. So the convolution and the effect of the stiffness of the PT spectrum, the jet, is already automatic taking into account in this case.
Did that answer the speaker's question?
A speaker question.
But you need one gluon of same each moment, right?
No. Not the case. I mean I have to spend another 10 minutes to discuss that. Yeah.
Okay. The question I was originally going to ask, I'll stick with the original. So, if it's a question of whether equilibration matters, is what I want to get to. In a certain sense, it shouldn't, if I take the lesson of Rolf's talk into account, that really what seems to matter most is energy density. Then it doesn't matter so much whether the energy, whether it's equilibrated or not, unless Edward is right, in that what Edward is saying is that in the very in the first one Fermi, before you have equilibration, you have the energy is very lumpy in space, and that will certainly lead to much larger energy loss. And I guess I want to ask whether both the last two speakers would agree that, you know, that at a qualitative level they're fitting the data without invoking Edward's idea of a lumpy initial condition, or whether they feel, you know, Edward said in a comment in response to after Rolf's talk, we need something more, and I'm wondering whether, obviously there are disagreements between the two speakers, but whether they both agree that we are missing something, or they would both agree that sort of things are roughly. Do you agree that with Edward that sort of something more like his lumpy initial state is needed?
I don't think I can answer that question, because as I should hear, that this the energy loss of this modification of the spectrum is only sensitive to the gluon density. And whether that gluon is inside your nucleon, inside nucleus, or is in a quark-gluon plasma, or the initial state even not thermalized yet, I cannot answer that question. The only sensitivity here is that I have this initial time locked. And then that timeout has to, is a time scale that that this produced clones actually become unsure or materialize. And that's the only parameter that that is, you know, you can debate whether it's intact like 0.2, 0.5, 1 for me. But other than that, I don't think I can answer that question from just from this experiment. And all I know is that the initial density is high.
Okay, as I will take the opportunity again to ask the last question, at least from the last speakers, it seems as if what one easy way of distinguishing if this interpretation is correct is, I believe if I did the algebra correct, if I take A on the order of 70 or 75, so the effect of, since it goes like length squared, length goes like A to the 2/3, for central collisions, you should see half the energy loss. And if you don't, then it's not right.
No. Presumably. What do you mean half energy, half of the energy?
If you go through half the distance, it should lose half the energy.
Yeah, but you have to take into account.
I understand.
The system expanding.
But by looking at A dependence, it should be, for central AA, it should be a crucial test of whether or not the interpretation is correct. Well, that's
parameter, yes.
But certainly for central AA.
Yeah, you really have to take into account expansion.
Fine, but nevertheless, if you don't see things changing the way you'd expect with A,
what
then
you
would be wrong.
What you will see actually is the increase of the initial density with the nuclear, and that you will see.
I don't understand. Are you saying you can't compute for small A? Of course you can.
You can, yes.
So you can see the difference.
Sure. You should see the A dependence there. Sure.
Let's thank our speaker.
Back at 4.